Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, June 5th, 2025, and our friend Graham Fuller is back with us. Welcome back, Graham.
Thank you. My pleasure, Nima.
Graham, I want to talk about the policy. We know that there are a lot of pressures in Washington to somehow go against Iran, go to war with Iran. But before getting there, to what's going on in the Middle East, we know that there was an attack on nuclear bombers in Russia, and the attacks on two bridges in Kursk and Bryansk regions in Russia. We had yesterday the two presidents, Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, talk to each other. How did you find the talk happening between the two presidents?
Well, we don't know a great deal about it. I think the talk was about, I think they said about an hour and 15 minutes. Neither side has given much detail. I'm not surprised because it's an extraordinarily delicate moment. I think the Russians were the ones who said that the Americans said that they didn't, the Americans, whoever those are, did not know about the attack, according to what the Russian spokesperson said. And also, I think there was a woman who, I don't know what her position is, but commented the other day that Trump did not know about it either. But as you well know, Nima, this is a deadly game. I mean, if Trump did know about it, it's a terrible problem. If Trump didn't know about it, it's a terrible problem. And there's no way around this. I think it's not surprising that really Trump may not decide ever to answer that question because it's too, the implications of the answer are too damaging.
Vladimir Putin, he said that he's going to respond to this attack on Russia. But when it comes to the nature of attack and the way that they were attacking nuclear bombers, something so much strange. And I don't know what would be the strategy, what would be the tactic on their part. But do you feel, I feel that people are somehow manipulating the administration the way that we haven't seen before. Or maybe we've seen during the first administration of Donald Trump. Because as you've mentioned, it doesn't matter if he knew that or he didn't know it, because that doesn't change the reality of his position, his responsibility toward what has happened in Russia.
Right. Well, Nima, first of all, I think one thing is worth pointing out, at least from my perspective. Many people are treating this as a fundamentally military attack with military implications. I don't think that's really what this was. I think this was a psychological attack and a political attack. I mean, this attack on those bombers, and we don't know exactly how many were destroyed, but this attack on those bombers did not change and will not change the nature of the war in Ukraine. It just does not. It simply raises the level of tension between the two sides. So I think it's important, from that point of view, it was a sensational Ukrainian, would I say NATO or British or whatever, accomplishments from a political and psychological point of view, but certainly not military. Also, I think it's very important to point out that I'm very glad that it's Putin and Lavrov who are in charge in Russia. I think you and I have talked about them before, but I consider them probably the two most responsible and generally thoughtful statesmen in the world. I don't think Putin is likely to go running off, suddenly deciding to do crazy things to respond to this. He's very slow in his responses, slow in the sense of not rushing. And I think he wants to consider all aspects of this problem before he makes a response. But of course he will make a response, he has to. The interesting question is, what response will it be? And that has many implications.
He said that they wanted, I think that was his analysis is so smart and so on the point when he said that these terrorist attacks were aimed at the negotiations in Istanbul. They wanted Russia not to go there. Here comes the question, who wanted that? Who did want Russia not to go to Istanbul? In my opinion, the only country who would be in that position is the United Kingdom.
Yes, the United Kingdom has been doing that for 200 years in some ways. And I think you and I have talked before that the British still like to consider that they are the genius statesmen who are guiding Trump by the nose to teach him how to be a great power in the world. The British have never gotten over the fact that they lost their empire, and that's why they're sort of clinging on to the coattails of Washington to show that they're still a great power and can do things. I agree with you. Nobody knows exactly, but I think logically the British were most responsible. But what does that mean, Nima? What does that mean? If you were Trump and you did not know, you were not informed about this, just think of the questions about who knew and did not know. Did the CIA know about, even if it was a British operation, surely did the CIA know about it? They must have known about it. Did they tell Trump or not tell Trump? What would be the meaning if they did not tell Trump? What would be Trump's reaction to the British if they pulled this operation and did not tell him? I think, you know, the implications are huge here. And I suspect that a lot of heads are going to roll in Washington, maybe certainly in Russia, and certainly in Ukraine as a result of this operation.
What's so strange, Graham, we had the Kursk region, the attack on the Kursk region in Russia, which is still the region, that region still has the influence of the attacks, is dealing with the catastrophe that has happened in that region. And so, on the other hand, we know that the British intelligence was somehow behind the Kursk region incursion. And right now they're doing the same with the bridges, with the nuclear bombers. What's so strange that they're somehow picturing the situation as though Russia is attacking them? Here is what Starmer said, and the way that he's trying to convince the public opinion in the United Kingdom, maybe in Europe, that we are defending ourselves, we have to build up the military. Here is what he said.
And today, following through on this review, I want to set out three fundamental changes that we're going to deliver. First, we are moving to warfighting readiness as the central purpose of our armed forces. When we are being directly threatened by states with advanced military forces, the most effective way to deter them is to be ready. And frankly, to show them that we're ready, to deliver peace through strength.
Graham, who's threatening them that we're not aware of? I don't see anybody threatening the United Kingdom, not Russia, China, nobody is doing this. And your take on what's going on with Starmer and his case?
Well, first of all, I think Starmer in my personal opinion, is a very incompetent and ill-informed and not experienced statesman among many in Europe who I'm afraid fall into that category. But this is the old story that, you know, we have to go to war and win in Ukraine to prevent Russia from taking over all of Ukraine, maybe taking over Poland, then tomorrow maybe taking over Germany, and who knows, maybe the next thing the Russians will be in the English Channel. This is the story that they promote. I don't think very many Europeans truly believe it, but I don't know. It's very good politics for Starmer, of course, to be the wartime leader, to spend money on weapons and things of that sort. But I think it's it's absolutely crazy interpretation of what is going on. But, you know, were the British behind this? I think we both agree it's very, very probable, but we still don't know whether CIA would have been informed. I can't imagine that they would not be informed that the British would go ahead and do something like this entirely on their own. If I were Trump or any American president, I would be enraged at the idea that the British could decide to bring my country almost to the brink of nuclear war by an act in London over which I had no control and no knowledge. So it comes back to this really critical question, who knew what and when? Furthermore, the other complicated question, several people have reported that this planning for this operation goes back, 14, 15, 16 months or something like that. I find that hard to believe in some ways, but if it did go back that far, what was the date on which they chose to launch such an operation? Was it because the next day Putin Trump would be meeting, or that Americans and Russians would be meeting in Istanbul? Maybe, but did they wait 18 months or 15 months for that moment? Very hard to answer that question, but I deeply distrust the Europeans on this. And it will be interesting to see who Putin decides to punish for this. You can make a case for him deciding to punish Germany, although Germany was not supposedly directly involved in this, but maybe to warn them about the use of these Taurus missiles. You could argue that they view Britain as the greatest single danger, and therefore they're going to punish Britain, but that then involves deeper NATO issues. I don't know how Putin will decide on what his target will be. My guess most likely is that he will strike some kind of NATO office training places in Ukraine. And I'm sure the British have a significant presence there. Maybe even the British embassy, I don't know. But these are really complicated and important questions.
Graham, here is what General Blain Holt, who's politically close to Donald Trump and his administration, said about what has happened in Russia.
Concerned about global or national security in my life than I am right now. And yes, I understand it's a tactical win. The Ukrainians have a tactical win. But they hit a third of a strategic bomber force that is covered by a START treaty that goes back to 2010. There is no Russian in the military there that believes that Ukraine was able to achieve this without Western intelligence help, including our country. Mm. General Khonikhaev, the leader of rocket forces for Russia, has now openly said they are now locking in the coordinates for Paris, London, and Washington, D.C. This is an escalation path now without a reverse gear. I pray there's a reverse gear that President Trump can find by calling President Putin. But as a military officer with 27 years of service at the flag level and NATO service, I can tell you we are in a big dangerous place that we weren't in 3 days ago. And I pray that something good happens in those talks today.
And the talk happened. The two presidents talked to each other. Donald Trump even talked about the case of Iran. But when it comes to the case of Ukraine, he said he didn't know about it. Donald Trump himself didn't know about what was happening. But as General pointed out, this is a huge responsibility for the Trump administration because of the gravity of what has happened.
Yeah, well, I said a moment ago that I'm very glad that it is Putin and Lavrov who are in charge of Russian foreign policy here, because there are many. Almost any NATO leader would not be as responsible or as wise or as sober as Putin and Lavrov will be. I think Russia understood quite clearly that this was not the prelude to a nuclear war. I mean, you could argue, oh my God, they took out part of our nuclear bombing forces, then that gives them an opportunity now to attack Russia with their own nuclear forces. I don't think Russia interpreted these events in that way. I think they interpreted them correctly, in my view, as a psychological and political operation. It's certainly a real political response to say that they are readying targets in Paris and London and Washington and Germany or wherever else. I think it's important for them to say that. In the end, we will see who they really do strike. And that will tell us something about how Russia understands this. Will they strike something related to the UK? Will they leave the US untouched in this whole thing, which would mean that they accept essentially Trump's statements that the US was not involved and did not know about it? I don't think Putin wants to expand this war by attacking several other European countries, which would dangerously invoke NATO response again. But yes, it's very, 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 very dangerous. But let's realize that this essentially was not a military operation as such.
Graham, I don't know if they know how to deal with the beast that they're creating in Ukraine, because as time goes by, it can backfire on them. These type of activities on Russian strategic part of army, on nuclear bombers, and these are not, when the Kursk region, the attack on the Kursk region happened, we all talk, what is happening right now? Who's behind it? It was something so much... It was a red line in our mind in those days. But right now, they're attacking nuclear bombers. I don't know how much Russia would be patient with these sort of activities getting much more radical as time goes by. It's like it means to me like what has happened in Ukraine. Russia tried to negotiate, tried to do everything. But when you push so hard against this spring, it comes to a moment that spring doesn't have not enough space to back down. It's just gonna come back and hit you. It seems that the case of Ukraine, these sort of attacks, these terrorist attacks that are happening, would bring something big after all, if they continue the same sort of escalation that they're doing right now.
Yeah. I do not believe that Ukraine was really in charge or having the final decision on this kind of operation. It's very convenient for NATO and Washington and others to talk about, oh, well, the Ukrainians are doing this or doing that or the other thing. I'm sure there's no doubt that the Ukrainians have been very brave and patriotic in fighting in this war, and they have paid a terrible price in terms of the economy and loss of human manpower. But I think to suggest that Ukraine is somehow driving the show, running the show, is very, very unrealistic. It may be convenient to say it's Ukraine, but Russia knows better. Washington knows better. I think the world knows better that, yes, Ukraine has gotten a lot of help, but it is not in charge of these events and these attacks.
I think, Graham, what connects this situation in Ukraine and in the Middle East is the policy of the United Kingdom. And they're somehow trying to... We know that in the Middle East, Netanyahu is doing everything to bring the United States into a bigger war with Iran and in the region. But when it comes to Ukraine, it seems that the United Kingdom is playing the same role in Ukraine to bring the United States. They're doing everything, by the way. They sent a letter to Donald Trump. Even Starmer convinced the King of United Kingdom to send a letter inviting Donald Trump to do everything. They're doing everything to convince the Trump administration to continue with the support to Ukraine. But how about the Middle East? I would believe that what we had last week with the case of the conservative leader Kemi Badenoch said these two wars are proxy wars on the part of the United Kingdom. Somehow Israelis are fighting maybe a proxy war for the United Kingdom. I don't know. But when it comes to the United Kingdom, do you have any sort of idea? Today I talked with Alex Craner. He said that these bankers, the city of London is running this show. What's your take on that? Because Starmer, to me, he's not that much powerful. He came to power just months ago. How he could bring this sort of might at his disposal to do this? There has to be something behind to support him.
Absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, and I think you and I have agreed on this, that the UK is doing everything it can to sort of take charge and lead, direct, influence the United States in its policies in order to demonstrate that it's still really the great power. Even if it doesn't have the weapons, it has the great strategic mindset and great imperial mindset. It's very often this issue comes up of London and the banking facilities of London. Certainly they are, the bankers in London are tied also with Wall Street to some degree or another. I have to believe that the deep state, if you will, in London, in England, UK, is driving UK policy, and certainly not Starmer. I'm not sure what the UK really believes they will get out of this, because obviously even bankers don't do very well if you have nuclear war. But it seems like the British are playing the game of chicken, if you know that game, of who will blink first, who will give up first, who will admit defeat first. And the British are playing a very, very dangerous game here. I think it also raises the question of the future of NATO, Nima. Again, if I were Trump, I would be at this point very, very angry and asking a lot of questions about why didn't CIA tell me, or why didn't CIA know? Does NATO have the right to lead the United States into a nuclear war on its own without consulting with us? Who is driving the boat? Who's driving the car on this whole thing? So I think if I were Trump, in many respects, I might wonder about the validity of NATO if I, as American president, have lost control of the most important aspects of the most basic issues of possible, probable nuclear war as a result of half-baked Europeans, so-called statesmen, making decisions that will destroy my country as the American president. I think NATO, this may be the beginning of the end of NATO in the question of who is deciding these issues and what is the foundation for those decisions. I think Germany also is in a very difficult position because it's become more militant, more military in its orientation, and with these terrorist missiles, which could also be very escalatory. Germany is in a very difficult position right now, and I would not be surprised if they were not included in some way in a response from Russia.
Graham, from the experience that you had for such a long time, and do you understand when we talk about the United States, the empire, the hegemony of the United States, can you point out how this sort of mindset that the US empire, we have to build in each and every continent and country a new military base, how this sort of concept has helped the United States? Or in my opinion, the United States has suffered a lot because of this sort of mindset. This sort of, we are the empire, we have to run everything. That would somehow destroy the United States from within. What's going on with the case of the United States when it comes to this competition between the United States and China? It wasn't China that caused these sort of problems in the United States. It was the United States making all of these problems because of the mindset, this hegemonic, this sort of the U.S. empire that they have to run each and every corners of each and every corner of the world. Can you point out a single benefit of this sort of mindset for the United States?
Well, the benefit, I think, is essentially ideological and political. There are many in the United States, including people like Lindsey Graham, who seems to have lost his mind, but many others in Congress, for whom this is extremely important, that the United States be number one, not MAGA, as Trump likes to talk about it, because that's primarily more economic or even social. But ever since the end of the Cold War, as you know, or ever since the end of World War II, the United States was basically the only country left standing and able to then move into the Cold War and take on Russia. So that mindset has not gone away. It's linked very much with the so-called neoconservative ideology, which is highly, it's an ideological view that I think maybe we've talked about before, I don't remember, but it came essentially out of Russia, out of Trotsky. And you remember Trotsky and Stalin, who were the great enemies. And Stalin said the task of the Soviet Union was to build socialism, build communism in Russia. That was the task. Trotsky disagreed. Trotsky said, no, world revolution in the name of communism is the task. And they had a falling out over that. And eventually Stalin had Trotsky murdered in Mexico City over this very same issue. But Trotsky believed in constant revolution everywhere in the globe. And the neoconservatives, many of whom come out of this sort of Russian Jewish tradition. Trotsky also was himself Jewish and had a mindset of that kind of thing. The neoconservatives have had this view that we are an eternal struggle for the greatness of democracy and freedom, blah blah blah, revolution, even if you will, against our enemies, and it's very hard to get rid of them. A woman like Victoria Nuland, whose name you may recall from some years back, was in charge under Biden of policy in Eastern Europe and Ukraine. And she was one of the greatest warmongers of all in talking about the need to ultimately to bring Russia to its knees, to destroy Russia's great power and maybe cause the country to break apart. That idea is still out there. The only positive thing that I can see about this is that Trump himself, a couple of days ago, mentioned that he would not be influenced by, he was in Riyadh talking with the Saudis, and he made brief mention of the fact that he did not accept the neoconservative view of constant warfare and constant confrontation. It's a small mention, but it's very, very important if Trump is essentially ideologically breaking with this powerful force, ideological force within the US government. I think that it will die a slow death, but I think it must die if it does not destroy America in the process.
Graham, when it comes to, you've mentioned this sort of animosity between the United Kingdom and Russia. Do you think it's just about Russia, or it can go beyond Russia, go to China? Maybe they have some sort of enmity toward China as well.
Yeah, very good question, Nima. I think we both are well aware of the background of the British-Russian enmity that goes back to the last century easily, when the British Empire viewed Russia as the great threat to the British Empire, and was very much constantly afraid that the Russian Empire was going to invade across the Himalayan mountains and down into India, which was the heart of the British Empire. So that's been a phobia, British phobia, going back a very, very long ways. I think the British still maybe have this mindset that somehow they're saving the free world, saving democracy, saving civilization. There are racist elements in this as well, and that I think there's an inherent distrust of third world or developing world or global south or whatever else that British have long had contempt for, because these people were part of the British Empire for so long. So yes, I think it does apply even to China, and Washington, sadly, even Trump has tried to convince Europeans that they should not deal with China without great, great caution. That's where we are at right now, but it's time for a complete change of mindset. I'm hoping that this serious crisis in Russia today, because of this attack on Russia's nuclear forces, that this may be the kind of crisis that will force an entire rethink about where are we going at all of this in madness.
The other issue that the two presidents talked about in the phone call, I'm talking about Trump and Putin, was the case of Iran. Putin said that he's willing to participate in the talks that are happening, or somehow facilitate, help to help the United States and Iran to reach a deal. Don't you think that when it comes to the crucial role of Russia, if they try to do something with Ukraine, with the case of Ukraine, get something with the case of Ukraine, Russia could have a very important role in what's going on in the Middle East and with the case of China, with Taiwan. But so far, I thought that would be the case for the Trump administration, but so far, I don't see that the Trump administration, or Donald Trump himself, has reached that sort of conclusion that Russia is important. Russia, we have to keep Russia close. That doesn't seem to me that would happen anytime soon. But as time goes by with the conflict in Ukraine, how do you see the situation with Iran? How do you see, because Donald Trump came out and said no enrichment as before. Witkoff every time is changing his rhetoric. 1%, 3%, no enrichment. Mainstream media reporting different sort of attitudes on different sort of mindsets in the United States. But what do they want from Iran that they feel that Russia can help them? Because I don't see, when I follow the Iranian media so closely, and I know there is no possibility that Iran agrees on no enrichment. And do you understand what Donald Trump what does Trump want from Russia to do with the case of Iran?
Well, I think you're absolutely right about Russians' ability to assist in this U.S.-Iranian conflict or face-off. Clearly, Russia does not want Iran to become a nuclear power. That simply complicates life for everybody. I mean, nobody wants nuclear proliferation, basically. So I think Russia very much understands that. And I think Russia has said in the past that it does not favor a nuclear Iran. But at the same time, obviously, Russia has offered, I think, some sort of support to Iran against U.S. pressures in this situation. And I'm sure Iran looks to Moscow to provide some sort of at least diplomatic backing for this confrontation with the U.S. I agree 100% that I think there's no way that Iran will agree to reduce its enrichment down to some tiny percentage or even stop it entirely. That's just fantasy. Perhaps this is Trump as a bargainer, that he wants to strike an impossible, pose an impossible deal to Iran, and then hoping that Iran will come back and this can be the foundation of for further negotiation. I don't know, but I think the Russian role in Ukraine in Iran can be extremely important. I also was interested, this is not quite what you asked, but it's quite related to it. I was struck today to see that Trump had a discussion with Xi Jinping. And the New York Times did not offer very much details, and it suggested that most of this had to do with trade and tariffs and things like this. I cannot imagine that Trump and Xi Jinping would have any kind of conversation that did not include the crisis in Ukraine and the recent attack on Russian nuclear bombers inside Russia. So it would be interesting. I'm sure China likewise does not want a nuclear Iran. The last thing China needs is to have a serious possibility of war between the United States and Russia. This would be catastrophic for everybody. So I think it's interesting that Trump did speak to Xi Jinping yesterday or today, that we don't know what he said, but I am pretty positive that they had to have discussed this broader geopolitical issue. And China maybe also is in a position to help. Just one other thing that comes to mind, Nima, it's quite extraordinary, vaguely related to this, but I read the New York Times, which I think is a terrible and unreliable and biased newspaper, but it's the most important American newspaper. So you have to know what it says, just like you have to know what Pravda says, whether you believe it all or not. It's stunning that in 2 days, the New York Times has not discussed this issue of the bombing in Russia. And coming back to this fundamental question that you and I have been just talking about in detail, who knew what and when? Did Trump know about it? Did CIA know about it? Did the British know about it? Who was behind it? What are the implications? Well, not one single word. I don't even know what to make of that kind of thing, except I think maybe they're almost scared, too scared to go to a very difficult issue, but it's certainly part of the irresponsibility of American so-called mainstream media.
Graham, if we look at the what's going on in Gaza, with the case of starvation, with the case of not only in Gaza but also in the West Bank, it's unbelievable what's going on there. Even Europeans are, one by one, they're trying to talk about what's going on. They're trying to go, the mainstream media is going against what Israel is doing in Gaza. Something is changing in the mainstream media considering Gaza. But after all, Graham, how these people in Washington how do they feel that the case of Gaza would help the United States, would somehow be positive, would somehow be beneficial to the foreign policy of the United States. I don't see anything good coming out of this. In history, they're gonna point at all of us and saying what you were doing during those days that these people were killed, were murdered in Gaza. I don't see that these people who are deciding about everything in the United States are aware of the gravity of what's going on in Gaza and how the history would judge all of us.
You're absolutely right, Nima. I fully agree, but let's not forget that there are two issues here. One is the tragedy and genocide of Gaza that we see before our eyes. And the other one is the need for large portion of American politicians to be responsive to Israeli pressures. And certainly Lindsey Graham is one of the foremost in being responsive to his, but not the only one. I mean, most senators receive large amounts of money from the Zionist lobby for their election, so they're part of it. So I think even Trump has to be cautious about how far he can go in alienating the Zionist lobby. It's a difficult guess. I think the Zionist lobby is actually losing considerable voice and authority in recent years, especially since this atrocious Gaza genocide, but they're still quite powerful. And they're able to, I think, cause major newspapers to be very cautious in approaching this issue. I am encouraged, yes, that even in the UK, we're beginning to see a little more open discussion. I think maybe the door has opened a crack, that it's okay to talk about it. But who is the very outspoken and aggressive British interviewer? Begins with M.
Piers Morgan.
Piers Morgan, exactly. You know that Piers, a week or so ago, made some very harsh attacks against what Israel was doing and said, I've changed my mind and all of this kind of thing. And yet I noticed Piers Morgan yesterday began to back away from this and be more cautious in what he said and attacked Palestinian spokesman quite savagely attacked his views. So my conclusion is that Piers Morgan has received some kind of warning or threat to be careful about how far he takes this anti-Zionist line. Nobody is completely free from all of this. It's tragic. I think time is moving gradually, but it's very slow, and it's tragic that it takes so much death to do it. Just today, I noticed in the New York Times that they had a story about a girl who was almost burned to death in a Freudian slip in an Israeli attack on her home, and she was rescued and badly burned. But there were pictures from the New York Times of this girl and being taken to, it was very clear that it was identified as the victim of an Israeli airstrike. I think this is personalizing a little bit the sufferings of the Palestinians, and maybe represents a point at which even the New York Times cannot stomach this much longer. Yes, there is Jewish pressure from Zionist forces, but there are lots of very liberal Israeli forces, I mean, not Israeli, Jewish American forces who are deeply upset about this. Jewish liberals who believe that this war in Gaza is creating the worst threat to Judaism anti-Semitism that the world has seen maybe since World War II, because all of this is being carried out in the name of protecting Jews, even with the American universities, arresting students, throwing them out of the country, all this kind of thing, blocking freedom of speech. In Germany, it's the same thing. It's all in the name, supposedly, of protecting protecting a Jewish community, but I think much of the world interprets this as not reasonable, and there's a pushback against Jewish communities, perhaps unfairly so, but they Jewish liberals certainly feel that. It's very disturbing.
The key is that they're trying to do everything to help the Zionists, not the Jewish people. The Zionists, and we know that Zionists can be Christians, Jews. <Right. laughs> Zionists, we have
But not Muslim.
We have Muslim Zionists. We have.
Oh, come on.
Graham, we have Muslim Zionists. Because Zionism, I think, is somehow a sort of mindset. It's sort of, they call it nationalism, but it's beyond nationalism. It's something so much. It's racism, Graham. It's not, all religions are dealing with Zionism somehow, some sort of Zionism, in my opinion.
I agree. Yeah. But it's unfortunate that we have both this terrible Ukrainian crisis and the Gaza crisis simultaneously. I don't know how they will influence each other, but my sense is that Israel, or at least those in power in Israel, are very sympathetic to supporting the Ukrainians against Russia. And as I said, many of the neoconservatives have come out of backgrounds, of family backgrounds of Russia, who remember sort of anti-Jewish pogroms and campaigns, even during Tsarist times, that were dangerous for the Jewish community. They have not forgotten that, and that is one of the reasons why many of these neoconservatives who are Jewish are very anti-Russian, just instinctively, and would like to weaken, not totally destroy, but deeply weaken any role of Russia in the world. There's a deep hatred of Russia and everything it stands for, even historically.
Thank you so much, Graham, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Well, my pleasure, Nima. These are disturbing issues, but we will have more to talk about, I'm sure, next time.
Yeah, exactly.
Take care.
Take care. Chodafez.